trying to train them up. So we started in several places. I remember there was a trial and examination whether or not we could run church in one or two places more cheaply, and we did. Mm. But this was the game. There were, as we were back at this business of trying to get us to convert more and more and more until you had no flexibility. And the idea that the thing is, a cook doesn't carry a rifle, or if he only doesn't pray, why have any military cooks? Well, you may recall during the war, some of the units had very bad morale because they weren't lucky enough to get good cooks. Most early rooms didn't run because they didn't have trained Army Service Corps stenographers then.
Yeah.
Because they'd all been done by civilians. Unless the civilian joined, then you didn't have that particular trade and duty. And this was always a problem. I may be getting off the track.
Yeah, no, you're quite true. There's another one here. Now, this runs down to 57, 58, and how much you had to do. That I know time is getting short.
Yeah, it's about 5 minutes,
isn't
it?
Yeah. No, this is a bit too long for 5 minutes. I think what we'll do, we'll end it right there.
Okay.
Because this runs through to July 58, and it deals with means and methods of introducing atomic capabilities into North American air defense system. Now here again, but just to speak on this very casually, without going into it in any detail, we'll cut right there. To what extent, Finn, might you or would you have been brought into a discussion, or would you be discussed, or would you be consulted at all? In other words, you have a situation where one arm of the service is concerned primarily, which is not your own. But on the other hand, it's a major defense policy.
Well, we're always, if it was of any major significance, it was always discussed at the Chiefs of Staff Committee. And all the Chiefs of Staff Committee was the chairman, was Charles Pope at the time, three service chiefs, and the chairman of the Defense Research Board.
Mm.
So these matters were definitely discussed, and that's where arguments arose. We might say, oh, we're not against this, you're taking it over, but not at the expense of this force or that one.
Mm-hmm.
The Navy would say, well, we need so many men to man the number of ships by types that we have promised we'll have ready on D-Day and so many days after, unless they have the trained people to do it. So your first concern was as a general policy matter, but then you had the three chiefs whose forces were either going to be affected. So it became, if there was, the first question always was, right, if we take on something or change something, do we get more men and more money for it, or do we have to do what we have now? And if we have to do it, let's examine all our commitments and see what we can do. But we just can't go on taking on this and that with no more money or no more men. And that was a constant debate.
It seems odd that the political people wouldn't realize the imposition, all these political decisions on you without making some sort of
One time, I think we should talk about this. What happened so often? We had a commitment of certain forces in being in Europe. The brigade group.
Yeah.
And then we would build it up to a division, and then later to a second division, right?
Yeah.
These we committed ourselves to, on paper, to our NATO partner.
Mm.
Well, then when we came to discuss something, to send people to the Congo or so-and-so, we would say, well, we have to have these ready. Well, then the argument would come up. Well, you know damn well we can't get these people overseas if it's a rough war, because we won't be able to get the shipping. Or if they drop a bomb on us, you're not going to have your people rush overseas. They'll have to work here.
Yeah.
Well, we said, fine. If that is the case, then let us file a caveat.
Yeah.
We have made a promise, and we as military people say, yes, we've been told we must have this, this, and this, and be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you know we can't do it, all right, let's tell our NATO partners and let us redesign her for us. But we felt that it wasn't right to have the political time and the political key and saying on one hand you would do thus, thus and so on NATO, and at the same time use the forces to do something else.
Do you think, and one fellow suggested this not too long ago, that this may have been a little bit part of Kirky's problems in that he was too honest a minister, that he was a man who was accustomed to making decisions, and he was an honest, forthright soldier type, and that he because of this he used to run into or run afoul of his political colleagues in cabinet.
I'm sure this happened. The trouble was from the politician's point of view, the people who were in the military,
the
Navy Army Air at that time, and it so happened our minister had been appointed, had seen the pitiful plight, the pitiful equipment of our regular force before the war. How inadequate we were. Even with the threats growing up that we believed that even the schoolboy could see, the rearming of Germany, the threats, we did very little both. And we were in very poor shape. Now, I think that all of us felt we don't want to be in that position again.
Yeah.
So, we tried to exert all the influence we could to make sure that our forces were as well equipped, well trained, and as adequate as we could possibly influence the government to agree to. Mm-hmm. So we had a minister who had been through this and knew more about this. He'd been at the higher rank. And probably with greater frustration.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
He knew that you couldn't use your broomstick in three or different ways at one time. I think this is how it is.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting...
Well,